This episode of Metatrex is brought to you by Enterprise in Space. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter. Visit enterpriseinspace.org for more information. And if you'd like to help us keep Star Trek discussion coming to you each day, consider becoming a patron of the network through Patreon. Visit patreon.com/trekfm and find out how you can become part of the team. That's patreon.com/trekfm.
This is Tim Russ, Lieutenant Commander Tuvok on Star Trek Voyager, and you're listening to Trek FM.
There's no greater challenge than the study of philosophy.
My philosophy is that there is room for all philosophies on this station.
Well, welcome everybody to episode 28 of Metatrex, Trek FM show on Star Trek and philosophy. My name is Mike Morrison, and with me, as he always is Zachary Frühling. In this episode, we're going to do something different, Zachary. We're going to be doing an essentials episode, something that's popular around the network. Various shows on Trek FM often do their essentials podcasts. Our friends over at To The Journey have probably done some of the more popular ones. And obviously on Warp 5, I've been privileged to be a part of some of their essentials episodes. So, Zachary, we thought it would be fun to have our own version of essentials. And we're going to be doing essentials philosophy. And we thought it would be fun to start with kind of the end of the franchise as far as live-action Star Trek on television. We're actually going to begin with Enterprise Season 4. So for this particular episode, we're going to be joined by a couple of special guests, and I just received a hail, and they are ready to beam aboard the Starship Theseus and join us over here on Metatrex. We have with us today Norman Lau. Norman is executive producer of Trek FM. He is also former co-host of Warp 5 and current host of Standard Orbit, Trek FM's show dedicated to the original series. Welcome, Norman.
Hi, guys. Permission to come aboard.
Permission granted.
Wow, this is exciting. This is so exciting. And those credits sound far more impressive than they probably are. But you know me, I love talking Trek. I love being a part of this network, and I'm excited to be on your show. So thanks for having me.
We're glad to have you aboard. And beaming aboard right now, this was tough because I had to get an Atavacron to even reach him. But we were able to catch him somewhere in time because he is quite a time traveler. Straight from the 22nd and occasionally 23rd centuries. Geoffrey Harlan. Geoffrey is co-host of Standard Orbit and also co-host of Warp 5. And I might also say, Geoffrey, you are the producer of Trekopedia, the unified theory of Trek. Welcome aboard.
Thanks for that. Glad to be here. I'm looking forward to this discussion we're going to be having today because I just love talking about Star Trek.
No, he doesn't. He hates talking about Star Trek. Just read his page. Read Trekopedia.com.
Read Trekopedia. He hates Star Trek.
No, I've been found out.
Well, guys, I'm really excited to have you guys on the show. I'm excited to do this essential philosophical Trek topic here today. I'm honestly a little scared because of all the Star Trek series, Enterprise is the one I know the least. So I'm really glad to have you guys here because I know you guys will keep me on the rails. Without a doubt, you guys know all the details of Enterprise more than I do. I've got a list of my essential philosophical Trek episodes from this season, but I can't wait to see what you guys have to say about these episodes. I'm sure you can run circles around me in terms of Enterprise knowledge.
Okay, so to be fair, so philosophy wasn't my strongest subject when I was in school, and Star Trek is probably my strongest subject as personally, so I'm going to probably have to lean a little bit on the baser essentials of philosophy just in terms of this conversation, because what I think is one term may be a completely different term. So just for me to be able to get the context right for what we're talking about, I'll probably just have to take somebody's lead and say like, oh, by the way, this means this, or this means this, or no, Jungian isn't what you think it is, Norm. It is not a fungus of some kind. So, you know.
we were talking before the show that, you know, which episodes we pick might tell us more about each other than it does about the actual topic of the show.
Yeah, it's very well. Oh, so this is a psychological profile. I get it.
Yeah, it's you're actually part of an experiment.
Oh, no.
Yeah. It's been 15 years since I took Philosophy 101 in college, so I'm a bit rusty on this myself.
Well, I think that's great, though, because the danger, I think, for me is getting tunnel vision. You know, I think when you're teaching philosophy or learning philosophy, there's a set sort of field of topics. You know, there's views that are sort of not well-received, but sort of the debates and the way they proceed and what the lay of the land in terms of what the disagreements are and what the positions are is kind of laid out, and you kind of know what that is as an instructor. But, you know, when you have new people in the mix, it's great to get a totally different perspective. I have no doubt we're going to throw each other for a loop today. I'm looking forward to it.
One of the things I thought would be fun about doing this, Zachary, is oftentimes, as you know, we will take a philosophical topic and we'll examine that topic through the lens of Star Trek. This is kind of backwards for us because we're going to take a season of Star Trek, in particular, Enterprise Season 4, and we're going to look at the topics, at least philosophically speaking, in season 4 of Enterprise that draw us to those particular episodes. It's kind of a backwards way of doing it. And I think rather than just tackling one topic, this will be much broader in terms of the philosophy. And I suspect that it'll be more of the morality plays and the ethics, I think, that will ultimately pull us in. But I think it'll be a fun way of discussing philosophy and Star Trek to look at it rather than a topic, but rather looking at the season as a whole.
Well, Mike, you mentioned that it's a little bit backwards. It's actually doubly backwards because we're starting at with the most recent, the last season of Star Trek that's been on television, Enterprise Season 4. And we're going to start here and we're going to work our way backwards. So this will be part of a series that we're going to do regularly here on Metatrex going forward. Maybe every 4 episodes or so, we're going to do one of these Essential Trek episodes. We decided to start with Season 4 of Enterprise because we figured everyone goes forward. You know, we could have started with the original series Season 1 or the Next Generation Season 1, but that would be the way everyone does it. We want to do it a little different on Metatrek, so we're going to start with Enterprise Season 4 and work our way backwards through every season of Star Trek just to be a little different.
Yeah, so this is going to be kind of like Mirror Universe Essentials, right?
Well, I have no response to that.
His brain is gone.
Mirror Universe. Well, I don't have a goatee right now, so, you know, we're going to try to keep this positive.
It's okay, I shaved mine.
I can't grow a goatee in either universe, so it really doesn't matter to me. I'd be the best spy.
Well, a little crepe hair and spirit gum. We can get you covered. So here's the order that we're going to go in. What we're going to do, we're going to share our top 3 Season 4 Enterprise episodes. We'll throw a couple honorable mentions in there based on philosophical content. Share a little bit about why that particular episode speaks to you in terms of the philosophies that are kind of presented and laid out. We'll go in order. Norm, since you are our Trek FM executive producer, that makes you an admiral.
Oh, no.
Ranking
officer. You're not a bad admiral.
You're a Commodore.
Yeah. I'll take Commodore.
Commodore Lau. So we'll put you in the captain's chair here on the Starship Theseus. Mm-hmm. And that'll be followed up by Jeffrey and then Zachary and finally myself.
We should say, too, before we get started, we should say that we have not compared any notes. I have no idea which episodes you guys have picked. You guys don't know which episodes I've picked. I'm sure there'll be some overlap, and that's okay. And that, if there's overlap, we'll know we really hit on the essentials.
Oh, sure. Sure.
Oh, yeah. There's always going to be overlap. Usually. And we also want to say that, I threw this question out on the Babel conference. We received a few responses back. I might even throw a couple of those in as well before we wrap up today's podcast. So without further ado, let's dive in. Norman.
Well, I think I'm going to have to start this one off on one of my favorite episodes of season 4, if not one of my favorite episodes of the entirety of all 4 seasons of Enterprise. And that's going to be Home. That's the 3rd episode. for season four. And the reason why I pick this is because Archer, to me, has been one of my favorite topics as a character, because he was the captain of which, or to which, all blame was heaped. Not just from the series' point of view, but from the fan point of view as well. Captain Archer had to endure everything for the first time ever. He had to endure the first losses on a ship. He had to endure the weight of command. He had to endure the repercussions of his choices. And all of the blame or the microscope that he was put under, and all of that, and more. So what I find most intriguing about Holm is that everything that you saw him react to was a direct result of the stress and the pressure of command. And just in terms of the philosophy behind this episode asks the question via Captain Erica Hernandez, what have you become? And are you going to go in one direction, or are you going to retain the status and nobility of command? And to me, that always kind of... It started this second phase of Archer's career, because from season one, he was growing. Season two, he experienced some extremes. In season three, he made some of the ultimate choices, especially in damage. And then season four, it's a culmination of what happens next. And he couldn't see it for himself. And I always found it interesting that they actually brought in Erica Hernandez, the captain of the NX-02, to basically put him in front of the mirror of himself and say, judge yourself and move forward, because this isn't the first time and it's not going to be the last time. So be the captain you've always wanted to be and learn from this and move on. That's essentially what this episode meant. And I thought that Scott Bakula played it brilliantly, because he was lost. And there was kind of like the moral play of him climbing the mountain, the challenge of him fighting his demons in the nightmare scene, and him just becoming human again in that very human of moments as he and Hernandez, spent the night together. It was just, he had to return to the normality of human existence and shed the captain and shed the weight of that and leave that behind him. And he had to grow. And I thought that was a very impressive moment for him.
Norm, I'm so glad you put it on the list. First of all, because it's not on my list, and that's great. We're off to a great start already. But the thing you described of the discussion with Hernandez being a mirror back at Jonathan Archer, in general, that's something Star Trek does so well, just turning the mirror through the dialogue, through the situations, through the moral dilemmas back at the human condition. And you're right, Jonathan Archer has been through a lot. And what I love about that episode, like I said, it's not on my list. I've got some others. But what I love about that episode is it forces the question of how a captain like Jonathan Archer, who's really had to endure trial by fire for a number of years, how he's been able to retain his sense of maybe naive optimism that he started out the run of Enterprise with. Going through all those challenges, how do you maintain this sense? And this is a question for all of us. How do we maintain this sense of optimism given the gruelingness of life sometimes, the challenges and the unexpected things that happen and the dangers and the disappointments? How do you maintain that sense of optimism? And that's a question for all of us. What kind of person do we want to be given all of those trials?
Yeah, I'm glad too, Norm, that you... this is actually number two on my list. I agree with you. This is one of my favorite Star Trek episodes, period. And you mentioned the mountain climb. And I think the mountain climb really was an allegory of sorts of this journey that he was taking. And Erica Hernandez being this mirror, she actually, I think, represents by and large... who he was when he started. She was there to remind him who he was when he started this journey out. And she was kind of this anchor to pull him back into that mindset of an explorer. And we've mentioned before that Jonathan Archer is actually the most existential captain in Star Trek. He's kind of a maverick out there. He's kind of out there doing his own thing. He can't just, call back and check in with Admiral Forrest, every time they encounter difficulty. So that level of existentialism to a great degree comes at a huge price for Archer. I mean, he doesn't have the prime directive. There are really very few directives. He's just out there, you know, talk about wagon train to the stars, this kind of almost no rules, and he's just kind of winging it out there. And that level of existentialism, I think, come at a great price for Jonathan Archer. So, you know, he has to take this climb up the mountain and examine his own personal identity. So for me, this particular episode becomes an exploration of the philosophy of his own personal identity and answering that question, you know, who am I going to be in light of everything that I've experienced? It's a powerful episode.
Jeffrey, was Home on your list as well, or do you have any thoughts on this one?
It didn't quite make my list, but it's up there for me, mostly because I appreciated how they portrayed basically that he's suffering from PTSD, and that's something mm-hmm. I also had to deal with myself over the last decade or so since I came back from the Middle East, and it's just something I really connected with there. Because that episode aired right around the same time that I had, it was about a year after I'd come back, so I was going through a lot of the same things at the time.
And what do you think that episode has to say in particular about PTSD?
I just really think that it shows that, everyone has to deal with these things. You know, there are things you go through, and it's just not something that we normally would deal with, and we just have to find a way that, you know, it breaks us down, and we have to find a way to overcome it and just get past it, and then eventually we'll be okay.
And I think in that episode, it strikes me that Jonathan Archer just feels alone after mm-hmm. having gone through everything he's gone through. Like, you know, people can't really, no one around him can relate to the incredible weight of responsibility that's been placed on his shoulders and on no one else's, and he's had to deal with it all essentially himself. And it's a good kind of cathartic episode. He finally mm-hmm. gets to unload some of it.
Yeah, I went through a lot of the same thing with that kind of feeling of loneliness. It wasn't until I joined up with the student veterans group at the university that I went to that I was able to connect with other veterans, and we had all been through the same thing, so we were all kind of able to just talk about it and go through it. And, you know, that, again, that really connected to me. That he went through that too, and it was really a good thing for me to be able to see at that point in my life.
Well, I think you hit on something. Captain Archer has to bond with a peer, right? He can't mm-hmm. Talk with people beneath him about this. He can't talk with the admirals above him. He needs to talk to another captain about this, and that's the only type of conversation he can have with a peer that really lets that cathartic conversation happen.
But he even said so himself when he was talking to Hernandez. You know, when I look at you, I saw myself 3 years ago, and yes. He was so disappointed in himself, mm-hmm. and. I think that was just really the nice tension that was built there, because every single time that Archer said something in that episode, it was always some type of reaction to, well, we should have had bigger guns, or tell them to put more armor on the ship, or maybe you'll feel differently if you deliver about a dozen eulogies. Like, everything was angry. He was angry at mm-hmm. everything, and he really needed to come back. And
yeah.
I thought that Hernandez internalized it. She's like, I understand what you're saying. But the reason why you've been chosen to be the captain is because you have the ability to move past this. And let's go all the way back to First Flight, when A.G. Robinson said the reason why they didn't pick you is because they wanted somebody who was flexible. You need to be a good captain, not just this person who follows the rules. Archer had to really struggle with that. So in not mm-hmm. following the rules, he set a precedent for himself because he had to grow outside of his command structure when he was in space, making the decisions by himself. He has to live with those decisions. And
yeah, we mentioned that Captain Archer is an existential captain. It really does kind of force the issue of existential authenticity. What kind of captain does he want to be, you know, in light of everything he's gone through, in light of the ideals that he's desperately trying to hold on to, that's disappointed in himself, that he's become so jaded. It takes someone else putting the mirror back at him and asking, you know, what kind of captain do you want to be? What is this all about for you? And, you know, we all have that question about our own lives. So I like that Star Trek, takes this issue of personal authenticity and just puts it out in space and forces a captain to think about it. But really, that's a question for all of us. We all, no matter what our situation and what our challenges and what our struggles are, we all have to, you know, every day in some way have to ask ourselves, you know, what is this all about for us? How do we keep pushing forward and defining ourselves given those challenges? So we could talk about this episode for the entire show if we're not careful. We should probably move on to talk about another episode. Jeff, so, do you want to toss over your first pick?
Well, I don't really have mine in any particular order, but I picked them all for different reasons. But the first one I got written down is Observer Effect. I thought it was really interesting. Yes. Just the whole the question of the ethics of the Organians and observing and not warning anyone about this disease and not doing anything with their knowledge of this disease. And also the contrast between Phlox's reaction in this episode, where he just berates them for not sharing the cure, when just a couple of years earlier in Dear Doctor, he was in the exact same position and didn't share the cure. And I thought that was really interesting, raised a lot of questions. And my thought on that was, you know, maybe he learned something during his time over those, you know, from the first season to the fourth season, his time with the crew, and his thoughts on the whole situation had changed compared to when it was the situation with Dear Doctor, as opposed to years later.
I think it's interesting to me that medical ethics is such a theme in this season of Enterprise in general. You know, we've got the Observer Effect, and that was one of my honorable mentions. It didn't quite make my top three list.
But same here.
It's really related to the issues you get in, say, Divergence. You know, what are the ethics of you know, if trying to cure people versus trying to eradicate the disease, and who you have responsibilities to, your responsibilities to the patient versus your responsibilities to society. And it really, it does seem to kind of boil down to this really complex, I would say, like a consequentialist or utilitarian calculation, you know, which direction will cause the most harm or the least harm for the greatest number of people. And you can see these different episodes playing with this consequentialist analysis of how to solve these issues. And it's interesting you said you think Phlox has evolved in some way. And I was sort of just reflecting on his role in the episode Divergence. Divergence was one of my top picks, and just strikes me that those are really related in some way. You know, how you go about trying to decide, you know, if you have the ability to cure a disease, that strikes me that the obvious thing is like, well, don't you have a responsibility to do that? Whoever has a cure. And then you say, well, okay, who else is affected and in what way? And you can kind of get stuck in these, you can almost talk yourself out of it based on who you're paying attention to and how much weight you're giving to which people for what reasons. And it just strikes me that it's never as obvious as it seems, because you can always go down a different rabbit hole of considering different types of consequences for different types of people.
Yeah, this was actually one of my honorable mentions as well. I almost put it on my top three, and I was almost afraid that it wasn't going to get recognized at all, because I talked to Enterprise fans who don't particularly like this episode. I don't understand that. First of all, it gives us a little backstory on the Organians that we met. Really, the first time we met them was in the original series, and what a really interesting species they were.
Then where did they go? They were always supposed to be there in the background. We never heard anything else about them until Enterprise. Right?
Yeah, just nice and quiet, and all of a sudden they, you know. But, you know, here we get a little backstory on them. And the really great thing is, you know, we're dealing, yeah, certainly with medical ethics, but, you know, we're kind of getting into epistemology a little bit, because this is their, you know, this is their exploration, their wanting to grow in their knowledge of how other species deal with things, you know, a little bit of empiricism there and pragmatism and idealism and, you know, this great exploration of knowledge and how you come across, how you expand your knowledge, and just the sheer fact that they're observing the morality and ethics of humanity in this way, it raises all kinds of really interesting questions that, I just think makes it essential Star Trek.
So this was my number three, and the reason why it was because, for many of the reasons that we've already discussed, but two things really kind of really like reached out to me, it just in terms of the Organians, and the Organians never ask permission. They just appropriated your bodies for their particular reasons. So there is, as an observer of the observer effect, there is an issue of like my own personal morality. It's like basically what they were doing is questionable as an action of a species, because it's not like they're doing it symbiotically or any type of like permissible relationship with the crew. They're doing it because they chose to do it. And now they're putting all of these different crew members in situations where they normally wouldn't be in, because this isn't who they are. They've stripped away the choice of the characters, and they're putting them into situations where normally probably not make certain choices. And then the other one was with Phlox, you know, with, and Zach, you actually made a really interesting point of this. We're talking about how a lot of medical morality has been put into the season, but this is based on what we understand as the Hippocratic Oath of the 19th, 20th, 21st centuries. This is what like human medicine has created. This, I'm a doctor, therefore I must protect life. How do we understand that other alien species believe in that same philosophy? And why would they? I'm not saying that they would or they wouldn't, but every single time that we saw the interspecies medical exchange, if you will, not the organization, but the way that Phlox reacted with other physicians of other planets and species, they were all on the same page. But I'm not actually convinced that other species would be on the same page, because that's a species level reaction, not a human species level reaction. So
Klingons weren't.
Well, yeah, right. So that's what I find interesting about this, is that when we project the morality of medicine on top of this, we're projecting our own morality, not the morality of, say, another species, so, or how a species would react to that. Definitely, I'd like to see what a natural, true Denobulan reaction would be, as opposed to somebody who's representing Starfleet.
I was hinting at earlier, was saying that in season one, I think his reaction might have been a little more of a Denobulan reaction, because everyone else, their first reaction is, well, we got the cure, let's give it to the Volokians. And now, here, 3 years later, three or 4 years later, he's had all this time that he's been spending around humans, and I think that's rubbed off on him, because now his reaction to the Organians is much different than his reaction was with the Mank and the Volokians.
That's a really great point, Jeff.
I'm really glad you guys are bringing this point up, because no matter what the philosophical issue is in Star Trek, you can almost always raise the issue of relativism. Is there one sort of universal answer to these types of questions, or is it really relative to species or race or worldview that you get in Star Trek? In the history of philosophy, there's plenty of philosophers that have held there are sort of universal answers to these questions. So when it comes to things like medical ethics, in fact, the example you mentioned, Norm, of using the crew members kind of against their will in situations they wouldn't be in, you know, that is not, you might say that doesn't take into account sort of the free will, or the, it's not respectful of the autonomy of the individuals who are being studied. And a philosopher like Immanuel Kant would say, you know, that regardless of what anyone's opinion about the morality of the situation is, there are these kind of universal principles of morality that, you know, if you're violating someone's autonomy or sense of or not treating them with respect as autonomous, rational beings, just like you are, then that's just plain wrong, regardless of the worldview, regardless of the situation, regardless of the consequences. And then in Star Trek, of course, you always have these other races, right? Different races look at it differently, and they've got a different perspective. So it's a really, you know, serious question. You know, if you encounter an alien race that has a really different perspective on morality, whether it's about medical ethics or about, you know, any other issue of morality inside Star Trek, is there recourse for saying, no, some races are just wrong about their views because they don't take into account these universal principles of respect for life and respect for autonomy and these values that seem they could be culturally transcendent? Or is it really just relativistic down to the particular individual or the particular culture or the particular race or the particular worldview? And you know, I don't have an answer to that question, but it sure seems like there are philosophers that have tried to give an attempt to you know, transcend that relativism by giving, you know, reasons to ground morality in something objective that transcends culture. And you can see that in Star Trek. You can say, you know, it's not, there's human morality, but you can say, look, I can respect Vulcan's autonomy, and I can respect Klingon's autonomy, and I can respect the Organian's autonomy. That's something that seems transcultural. So I guess my ultimate point is just that, you know, when you encounter these issues in Star Trek, there's kind of two ways of doing it. You can kind of do it anthropologically. You can say, what do the different races in Star Trek think about this issue? And it's very interesting to do kind of this comparative analysis of what the different species and races think about all these issues. And then you can say, well, what reasons are there for trying to ground an answer to these questions in a way that's transcultural or trans species in Star Trek? Is there any kind of universal morality that's relevant that we can take all of these different races' views and analyze them in terms of something more fundamental? It's really open question, and you can go either direction with it, I think.
Well, I mean, just to make a final point on it, if you leave our discussion now and go to Star Trek VI, there's that really interesting scene where Chekov says we believe that, you know, all species have a certain he's talking
claim
about
to inalienable human rights.
Exactly. And then, yeah, right. I can't remember her name. Jeff, help me out.
Azet Burr.
Yeah. She said that, you know, listen to what you're saying, inalienable human rights. I don't think that's our fault projecting that in terms of what we're watching. I mean, that's just a human reaction, but that's the beauty of Star Trek. It's forcing you to understand everything from a different lens. Even if you can't really wrap your brain around it, at least it's giving you the opportunity to open something up.
I think it's really difficult to tell for any one of us at any point in history, at any point in our lives, you know, which features of our views are contingent on our own stations in life, you know, our own little narrow perspective and our window into the world, and which things we really are latching on to something that's universal. Like, I would say respect for another being's autonomy. I mean, that strikes me as something plausibly universal, right? I can do that with the Klingons. I can do it with the Vulcans. I can do it with whomever. And then there's all these biases and prejudices and even these linguistic prejudices, like the thing you mentioned about, you know, inalienable human rights, right? That phrase is so loaded with biases and it's amazing that they pack that into that scene in Star Trek VI. But arguably, if you strip all the biases out, you can say, well, hey, isn't there something universal about respect for another being in general, regardless of these biased terms?
You know, it occurs to me, Zachary, you mentioned respecting autonomy. It occurs to me that when a Klingon has a batleth to your throat, you have no other choice but to respect his autonomy.
I surrender.
So, Zachary, how about you? What's on your list of essentials?
Well, this was actually really hard for me. And again, mine are in no particular order, but just to kind of mix it up a little bit, I have a couple other episodes that are about medical and biological things. But one thing that an episode that struck me is the Anar. I'm pronouncing that right? The Anar.
Mm-hmm. Anar.
Yeah. What I love about that, it's just a little feature of that episode. It's not even the entire episode that really moves me, but I like this idea of consciousness at a distance. The idea that you can be in command of a starship from remote control. To me, it raises these really interesting metaphysical or epistemological questions about the nature of consciousness and how exactly that's tied to the world around us. You know, if all your sensory apparatus is remote, you know, if you're hooked up to some holographic projection somewhere and you're getting these sensory inputs from somewhere else, it's a very interesting question to me where exactly you would perceive your consciousness being. Would you perceive your consciousness being back here on your planet, or would you perceive your consciousness as being out there on the ship? You know, because that's where all the sensory inputs are happening. That's where your interaction is happening. And I don't think that's an obvious question at all to answer. Like right now, I feel like I'm here in my office, but because my senses are here, right? That's where I can see, that's where I can hear, that's where my headphones are on, you know, all this stuff, that's where my sensory input is happening. So yeah, that's where I feel consciousness. But I don't think it's obvious at all. And a secondary thing about that episode is just that it raises these interesting, you know, fairly contemporary issues about the ethics of drone warfare, right? If you can fight a remote mm-hmm. war, what does that mean for how we think of what warfare should be and what's fair and what and not fair in war, what's right and wrong and justified and not justified? Does it change our attitude about the value of life if we can fight and kill remotely? It's really supposed to be an allegory for this contemporary drone warfare way of fighting wars that's been an increasing trend in warfare, right? You know, as automation and remote control gets better and better and better, we can fight wars remotely. We don't actually have to go put ourselves on planes necessarily and go fly and put ourselves at risk. And for me, that it points out the danger of devaluing the risks that we take in going out and fighting a war. You know, traditionally, when you go out and you fight a war, you put yourself at great risk. You have to deal with the casualties on the home front and the casualties for your own troops and your own fighting force. But if you can fight remotely, all those risks go away and you can go out and wage war without any real risk. And to me, that really changes the nature of war. So I kind of like this episode for two reasons. You know, it has these interesting issues about consciousness and what its nature is. It's an interesting sort of philosophical thought experiment. But, you know, more practically, I think this issue of remote or drone warfare is very contemporarily relevant. Probably will continue to be more and more relevant as our tools get better.
So did that pop up on anybody else's list?
Not mine, but I just wanted to kind of make a little bit of an analogy here or a parallel, because some people say that Enterprise or the writers didn't do a good enough job understanding the original series. Zachary, what you just said was literally the first of the two bookends to A Taste of Armageddon, which was in the original series, because the whole point of that episode was that warfare was the morality and the pain and the destruction and the chaos and the gore, all of that was removed from warfare, so it became acceptable. All you had to do was report to the station to be disintegrated based on the destruction of your grid. That was it. There was no stake involved. No one had any skin in the game anymore, literally. And that was very much like what was happening there in the Aenar, because that drone proved that the war can be fought from a distance and that you don't have to invest all of the resources, especially your own people. Once you remove the human element, or in this case, the Romulan element, once you remove the life out of that situation, it becomes a lot more sustainable as a weapon, as being able to mechanize your willpower against another species.
Yeah, and for me, it's hard because it doesn't necessarily even boil down to a philosophical argument for me. There's something kind of viscerally repugnant about that view of life and that view of warfare. It really kind of cheapens the value of life. And, you know, we can debate arguments about why life is valuable, but there's this kind of inner moral sentiment I have that life is more valuable than that. And that flippancy about the seriousness of war, even if it solves a problem, like in that episode of the original series you mentioned, that solves a societal problem, right? Actually, their view is that they're actually preventing harm by approaching warfare in that way, and so they're justified because that's the lesser of the evils that they see compared to actually fighting what we would think about as a real war. But it's still, I think, I'm curious to get your guys' sense on this, because for me that approach really just viscerally strikes me as morally questionable.
Oh, I agree completely. And Norm, I was actually thinking about Taste of Armageddon, and I kind of hesitated to speak up and say anything because obviously we're looking at Enterprise, but you're exactly right. There is a direct tie to Taste of Armageddon. And it's interesting because Zachary and I recently did an episode where we discussed euthanasia. And we kind of debated in the Turbo Lift before we recorded that podcast about mentioning this particular episode in that conversation. And we mutually decided, this is kind of on the border, Taste of Armageddon being on the border of euthanasia. But it struck me when I looked at that particular episode and thinking about euthanasia, just how casual they looked at life. And you're exactly right. You just, you know, your particular grid was destroyed, so we're going to march you off. We're going to euthanize you based on, you know, a computer projection. And man, when you begin to view life in such a flippant way, I think you're really on the precipice of a very dangerous mindset.
Jeffrey, you mentioned your experience with PTSD and being a veteran. I'm really curious to get your perspective on this as a veteran. You know, what does this kind of technology and how it relates to fighting a war? What does this mean to you as a veteran?
Well, actually, when I was in there, they were really starting to ramp up the use of drones. This was contemporary to this episode, and there is actually a debate going on in the Air Force because they're the ones that handle the flying of the drones, with the question of whether or not the pilots of the drones who aren't even on the same continent should be pulling down combat pay because they're flying the drone in combat, but they are not physically in any danger because they're in a simulator chair, basically. But then the counter-argument is that they're watching all of this on the screens. They're seeing where their bombs are going. They can see the video camera in the bomb as it goes into a building, and they see the people moments before they're detonated. And from that argument, they're saying, well, they should get it because they're getting the psychological effects of war, even though they're not physically there. And so it's been back and forth in the military on that one for quite some time, actually. And there's also been some talk of automating the drones to a degree where you can program them in to do a strike at a certain GPS coordinate. And then there's also, you know, the inevitable, well, have you not watched the Terminator movies? You know, don't give too much control to the AI. There's been a whole lot of debate on the use of drones and also AIs on the drones.
So I'm going to kind of put you in the hot seat just a little bit. So, you know, which direction do you kind of take it? Do you tend to think that this is a good thing because it, you know, it reduces the risk to our own troops and our own fighting force? Or is this a questionable way of fighting a war for any number of the reasons we mentioned? You know, which, you know, it might be all the above. I mean, these are complicated issues, right? Who's affected by what and how much, and, you know, how many lives are we saving here versus how many lives could we be harming here? And whose lives do we prioritize? Do we prioritize the lives of our own citizens versus the lives of the people we're fighting? And it's very complicated. There's no obvious answer. But which sort of direction largely rings true for you?
I think there still could be a middle ground with it, because there's still the it's referred to as the law of armed conflict, and there are very specific rules on who can and can't be targeted in a combat zone, and the circumstances under which someone can change from being considered a civilian to a combatant. And it gets very muddy over there with all the insurgent fighters. But there are very strict rules on, you know, like bombings of certain types of buildings and certain population centers. And we already take great pains to try to minimize the civilian casualties. I mean, when you compare, you know, the back in the World War II, where our bomb sites were not very accurate and we were basically carpet bombing entire cities, and compare that to now, where we've got laser guided sites that can pinpoint a specific bedroom in a building. I mean, it's come a far way from where it used to be, and at the same time, that has actually made it easier for fighting war, because it's less bloody and it's not as distasteful to some people.
You know, it's interesting. My grandfather was a B-24 pilot in World War II, and he flew in the South Pacific, and I've got a record of his bombing missions. He crash-landed a B-24 dead stick. These really traumatic experiences. And for the rest of his life, he was troubled by the fact that he had killed people in the war. You know, and never seeing their faces, of course. This is all from dropping bombs from a plane. I can imagine the difference of degree of responsibility you might feel if you can literally see the people who are being killed, you know, on the video screen as you're flying these drones or firing the missile remotely. You know, I guess, you know, the fundamental, you know, question I have is, you know, what is the reaction of the people who are responsible for the act for flying or fighting these actual missions remotely? Have they found, I guess the concern of this kind of approach to warfare is that it will cheapen people's views of life. Is it too easy to push the button and fire the missile or fly the drone if you don't have to put yourself at risk? Does that sort of cheapen people's views of life? Or have there been really, really good strides to make sure that that the respect for life, even when we have to fight a war, and it's terrible that we do sometimes, but the respect for life is always kind of taken into account? And I don't know even how he would settle that issue, but it just the concern just seems like, you know, if all you have to do is push a button and fight a war, then the seriousness with which you treat the respect for life, even of the people you have to kill in a war, would be lessened in some way. I feel like I'm not phrasing that very well.
Well, It's always been up to the individual to find a way to rationalize what we do in the military. I mean, it's a question of, you know, doing something distasteful for the greater good, basically. You know, we take this person out of the equation so that they can't hurt, you know, hundreds or thousands of other people. And that's kind of the way to rationalize it, and it makes it easier, but it's still not easy. And it's something that everyone has to come to grips with, and that's a big part of why there's a lot of veterans, you know, with PTSD, because we all have to find our way to deal with it, and some of us are more successful than others.
Yeah, and I think this is the kind of thing that this episode may not really ring true to people that don't have some experience with this. You know, mm-hmm. you know, this is a very contemporarily relevant issue, especially for, you know, 10 or so years ago, right? Mm-hmm. You know, we're just getting this technology. We had, you know, the wars in Iraq, the war in Afghanistan. This is an excellent example of Star Trek, you know, being relevant for the times. And I think Enterprise in general just doesn't get credit for having that kind of, you know, heavy social and political relevance that you know, some other, like, let's say, the original series had in the 60s. And it's a shame, because you can find these really ultra-relevant stories, and if you're not clued into the importance of those particular issues, then, you know, these episodes might fall a little flat. But I love that episode in particular, because it really raises, you know, these really, really relevant issues, and that strikes me as, you know, the soul of Star Trek. Let's see. Well, where were we? Who is next on the list here?
I think Mike was.
Mike, I think it's your turn.
Well, guys, top of my list, the episode Daedalus. You know, I put this on my list for a lot of reasons. You know, first of all, it's a great moral and ethical play. You've got the hero worship with Trip, and, you know, kind of seeing Emery with, you know, these rose-colored glasses on, worshiping the ground that he walks on. But, you know, the great thing about this particular episode is you take a great man, and by all measures, Emery is a great man. He as far as his scientific breakthroughs, giving us the transporter, you know, he's a great man. He's done great things. But he's also a man, we don't realize this at the beginning of the episode, but he's also, you know, a man who's very tortured, because the cost of science was his son, who's still trapped out there somewhere in a matter stream. And so what does a great man do when he's desperate? And we get to explore that a little bit. And I think they did it so well. This is such a, you know, such a human story, because sometimes great people do questionable things. And one of the things that I appreciate about this episode was that it came at both his science and his radical actions in the episode come at a tremendous cost to him. This particular episode, I never thought about the metaphysics of the transporter until I saw this episode for the first time. In fact, Emery brings that point up, and he says, you know, hey, we've already had these kind of metaphysical debates over this thing. Basically, I don't want to hear it. And I think the shame here is that we almost got the transporters too quickly in Enterprise. I almost wish we would have spent 3 seasons transporting inanimate objects and everybody afraid to use it until we got here to season 4. I would have liked to have seen those kind of metaphysical debates in relation to the transporter. You know, son being caught out there in a matter stream. What is he? Is he human? Is he worth saving? Is he alive? Is he dead? What an incredible metaphysical exploration this is. And then you've got, you know, kind of Emery's own egoism playing in there. Such a powerful episode, I think.
For me, this was the episode where they actually challenged the notion of who has the right to play God.
Yes.
Who has that right? Is now, has God been given the power of technology, and who wields that technology? Because the very first time that I actually was able to come to grips, I was raised Roman Catholic. I'm not a practicing Catholic per se anymore, but I was raised Roman Catholic, and I appreciate and try and understand the fundamental base of all religions. But when you see what the transporter really does and what it really means, it forces you to basically look at the recreation of the soul, if you believe in the soul. Mm-hmm. Because some people don't, some people do, and I understand that. And if a person goes through a transporter and has broken down into data and is recreated on the other side based on that data, what does that mean? Also, in Star Trek, they always talk about being able to optimize the pattern buffer and the data by a tenth of a millionth of a percentile. If that's off in the slightest, you do not come back the exact same person that you left in. You are off that much.
Yeah.
So you are 99.9999999% of Mike when you come back off the other side, right? That means you are not the same person, theoretically. If you really want to put a parameter of a metric on it. So what does that mean? You know?
Yeah, you're exactly right.
So when I was watching this episode, and I understand, like, you know, he's Erickson, his egoism, he's trying to save his son. But even above all that, when you really look at the transporter for what it really means, it gives somebody the ability to recreate man through technology in an instant. That is, if you're a religious person, that is wielding the power of God, because you can do anything that you want to that person. And that goes into the whole, why don't they let people just take weight out of them or replace hair follicles or, you know, manipulate the DNA or take out certain mutations? Because the whole point of the eugenics wars was that you are not allowed to genetically manipulate human beings. But if you,
and yet we did it in season two of Next Generation,
right? Yeah. So that's,
and then we haven't even gotten into Tom Riker with that either,
right? So this kind of like goes into the whole measure of a man thing, because once you allow somebody, it's kind of like Scotty. Scotty is God. I'm going to transport somebody, break him down to his bare essentials, recreate him to the other side. It's it's whether or not my ability as a transporter chief or operator that person survives.
Heck, Scotty even created whales.
In water. <Star Trek 4. laughs> So, I mean, not to belabor the point, but that's what I really get out of this episode, is that the technology of being able to act like God.
Well, Norm, this connection you're making is really interesting, because I think you can treat these issues as really separate, right? The transporter raises these really interesting questions about the nature of personal identity and the nature of consciousness. What exactly is it about what's going on in our brains or our bodies that gives rise to consciousness? Is it something dualistic like a soul, where there's this real issue of your body being recreated, but where the heck did your soul go when you're transported? How does it, if it's duplicated, are there two souls? Those really hard questions. But at the same time, you know, there's all these physicalist theories of consciousness, that consciousness in some way is intimately tied up with whatever's going on with your brain state. And that literally just gives rise to consciousness in some way we don't understand. So on the one view, if you take someone apart, then there's this interesting question about their soul. But, you know, on these physicalist views of consciousness, then if you reconstitute the physical matter in some way in the exact same state, and that will give rise to the exact same consciousness as before, and the problem kind of goes away. But you can treat those issues on their own. It's a very interesting philosophical questions. But you're right. It's really tied up with this radical empowerment of whoever's controlling the transporter. You can create duplicates. You can, you know, take someone apart. You can put them back together. It's very godlike. And
animation for a century.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. That's right. And Star Trek has a very sort of specious relationship with godlike beings. You know, I mean, think of the godlike beings we get in Star Trek. They're always these sort of pseudo gods that have some fatal flaw in some way. What does that tell us if we're to the point where we can literally play God in that way about ourselves, and mm-hmm. the sort of radical responsibility it gives us? And I just find it incredible that they've solved all the metaphysical issues in that episode and they've stopped worrying about it, right?
Well, first of all, I mean, I don't want to forget to say this. I want to say this. So again, with the whole, like, they don't understand that Enterprise and the original series have this great relationship, this is basically a bookend to The Enemy Within. Because that's exactly what happened to Kirk. Kirk was divided into his two base natures. You know, you had, you know, the passive and the aggressive. So that's when I just don't get it. Like, when people see the transporter happening, you have to realize what's going on there. What's going on there is that you are not returning the same as you once were, because the pattern buffer is never, or the technology is never at 100% efficiency. It never is. They always make mention, like, make sure that it's tuned up because, you know, you have to have all the data come back. But if, even if it's, the percentile is off, in the most minimalist of units, you are off. Something about you is different.
But how Norm, is that different from, say, ordinary change over time? Like, for example, I'm not the same person I was yesterday. I have different experiences. I've lost some skin cells. You know, all these things you can say about how I've changed, much less over years, over decades.
Because that's organic. That change is organic.
There's a core personal identity that seems to persist despite all of those changes, even changes in personality, even changes in experiences. So what those seem like greater changes than the minute change you're talking about in a transformer,
because,
in a transporter.
Because those changes are organic and sometimes by choice. The transporter is supposed to return you to the same state that you are in. Now, it very well could have been very minor. You may have missed a toenail. Or it could be very major, like you have a brain neuron that's not firing correctly. Therefore, it changes your personality or alters the alchemical nature of the way that you think. You don't, like, there's, it's supposed to, you know, it's supposed to be right. But what I'm saying is that when you break something down into nothingness and return it back into something, that has so much weight that it throws around in the religious arena.
I was just thinking that in the future, in the 22nd and 24th centuries, the toenail clipper business has totally fallen flat because they just run you through the transporter, trim your toenails, and you're good to go.
Oh, it would work for flocks, you know.
but his poor critter in the sick bay would
starve.
He's
in the transporter room all the time.
I want to throw a question out to you guys. So say you have this, a stellar candidate, you know, top of his class, this, that, and the other thing. This is before transporters were, you know, even remotely being thought about. And then all of a sudden, this person's forced to use the transporter, but his belief system does not allow him. Do you drum him out of this? Do you drum him out of Starfleet? Do you not let him participate? How do you do that?
I thought you were describing Dr. McCoy for a minute. He didn't want to use the,
that's exactly,
he didn't want to use
I was
the transporter
saying.
At all. He got drafted.
So. I'm just saying, you know, it's kind of like... It's kind of like in the military, Jeff. I'm not sure if you have experience with this, but what happens when the system conflicts with your belief system? What happens?
There was actually something in the news recently. There was an officer in the army, I believe, and he's a Sikh, and his religion requires that he wear the turban and the beard, and that's... that's a conflict with the military dress and appearance standards that state that, you know, they're supposed to shave their hair and shave off their beard. And he went through the system and got the there's actually a religious waiver in place for him that he can wear the beard and the turban. And he actually has a turban in the camouflage pattern of the rest of his uniform. But I've seen photos of him, and it's actually rather amusing to see. But I think that they would probably find some way to make it work, some exemption system.
I just love to see if that was tackled in some way, you know, in dramatic form. I thought that would have been kind of interesting.
We had Pulaski on the beginning of season 2 of Next Generation. She insisted on coming over on a shuttle.
Yep, she refused.
That's right. That's right.
She and refused. Barclay's afraid of the transporters for a while.
Yeah.
Well, that's just it. You know, again, we're talking about kind of the criticism sometimes that Enterprise gets. This is honestly probably it is my favorite transporter episode in all of Star Trek. You know, we split people into, we've done that. We've sent people into parallel universes. We've done that a couple of times. You know, we keep kind of regurgitating these transporter stories. Although I've got to give Voyager credit, Tuvix was very original, but this particular episode was so original. I mean, it's like something old, something new.
Yeah, I think it's a challenge
with transporter stories.
After 750 hours of television, it's really a challenge to come up with new ways of telling these stories. You just have to give the writers credit for finding new ways to tell these stories, and
this
it'll be interesting to see what they do. Let's say again.
Yeah,
this and Vanishing Point.
Vanishing mm-hmm. Point. Yes. And yet, Zachary, they did, and they did it so well. I mean, we got to explore dualism and emergentism, and all of these metaphysical questions pop up in the midst of this episode. And then we have the morality play and the ethics, you know, that are playing into this, and Emery wrestling with his own ego, and just such a well done episode all the way around, as far as its storytelling is concerned.
So it sounds like Daedalus then is definitely essential Trek. Norm, and, what's your next pick for essential?
You know, I have this on my honorable mentions, and my question was, who in the right mind would use the thing after everything that happened?
Yeah, and that's a great question for all. Would we actually go into a transporter given the chance?
Yeah, and there is actually, before this episode came out, there is a Next Generation graphic novel that came out about a year before Enterprise premiered. It was called Forgiveness, and it takes place about a century before this episode, and it's about the first person to develop a transporter, and you can kind of make it work together. But basically, he is being assaulted with all these same problems from like religious groups and from politicians as he's trying to develop the transporter, and ends up somebody is trying to kill him for developing this technology, and he sends himself into a transporter to try to escape, but something goes wrong, and like the beam, instead of going to the next platform in like the next town over, gets shot off into space, and like 400 years later the Enterprise E picks him up.
And that, Metatrex listeners, is why Jeffrey Harlan is affectionately known around the network as Mr. Atos.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a good story. It's called Forgiveness. It was published by Wildstorm.
Well, to round out my choices, and I have to, you know, I have to credit this as the two-parter, but more the first part than the second part, it would be Demons and Terra Prime. Because the one thing that I always appreciate in any science fiction story, and they did this on Babylon 5 probably better than most, is bringing the bigotry and the racism and the xenophobia of humanity back to the surface. Because in Star Trek, we're supposed to believe that we've made it past that point. And especially in the original series and moving forward, we believe that we have. But this is Enterprise. This is before Kirk, and this is before Spock, and this is when humanity was just finally making it to the stars through the nature of the Warp 5 engine and the NX program. But did everybody believe that? Was everybody on board with that philosophy that we were supposed to go out there? Because after the Zindi attack at the end of season 2 and then the course of season 3, humanity has rallied against Starfleet and basically said, through the leadership of John Frederick Paxton, no more. You are the reason why aliens have come to harm us. We were fine until you went out into space and started basically just coming into contact when we weren't ready and causing conflict when there shouldn't have been. So you can take all of the fear and all of the anxiousness and the anxiety, and which was also heaped on Archer, and said, like, you know what, Starfleet, you were wrong. You were wrong, and you have done this to us, and we are going to make a stand against it. Again, through the leadership of John Frederick Paxton. So I thought they were going to actually tackle this a little bit earlier with the way that the Earth Cargo Authority was getting their shipping lanes kind of infringed upon with Starfleet. I mean, why do you need the mail service when you have UPS? It's kind of like, why do you need, you know, these old, you know, cargo ships when you have a Warp 5 engine to deliver your mail out into further space? So, and you kind of like felt that a little bit. But what I really wanted them to explore further, if they got more seasons, was that humanity didn't necessarily always agree with Starfleet, even if Starfleet was the brightest and the shiniest. That's not representative of all of Earth. It was representative of a small portion who had the technology and the means to go out there, but not necessarily the permission of the entirety of the species to do so. So who speaks for them?
And that's... Norm, I love that you put the mini arc of Demons and Terra Prime together as one choice, because I did the exact same thing on my list. So I'm going to check one of mine right off the list here. But this is yet another example, I think, of Star Trek being contemporarily relevant. I just think about this idea that as we go out into the galaxy, it turns into something like a galactic melting pot, right? You know, we're going to see these examples of xenophobia, and we're going to get mixing with you know, even the storyline of the baby that was created from T'Pol and Trip,
Elizabeth,
right?
Yeah,
Elizabeth. Exactly. These are kinds of things you get in a galactic melting pot kind of environment. And you know, in the latter part of the 20th century into today, we've seen a progressively increasing globalization. Right. You know, we live in a global world now where cultures and peoples mix, and that's the norm. Right. This idea that we can sort of segment ourselves off in an isolationist kind of way is you know, year by year, decade by decade, less and less realistic. And that's going on inside Enterprise. And so in my mind, this xenophobia is really a commentary on the contemporary situation. You know, coming out of September 11th, you get this, you know, xenophobia, for lack of a better word, about cultures and races, you know, fear of Muslims and the, you know, these kinds of things that are happening in, you know, right at contemporarily when these episodes are coming out. This is a perfect example of Enterprise, you know, reflecting back on the state of society we're in this increasingly global society.
Yeah, this was an honorable mention on my list as well. I tried not to go with whole arcs, so I actually chose Demons of the two of them. But you hardly can't separate one from the other. It's almost like a single 2-part episode. Mm-hmm. But for all the reasons that were mentioned, and Zachary is exactly right. You hit the nail on the head there. You know, kind of that contemporary. Commentary about our world post 9/11, and we actually explored that a little bit earlier in the season as well, with the Forge Awakening and Kirshara to some degree, because this intergalactic war just about breaks out, and xenophobia, at least the seeds of xenophobia, I think, are being sown, and it's almost as though the events of the Forge Awakening and Kirshara carry over, and you can almost create a bridge or an arc between the two stories.
In fact, Mike, I'm gonna cross another one off my list right now. That mini arc you mentioned of the Forge Awakening and Kirshara, that was another one of my top three. But that's for a slightly different reason. I just found the deep dive into Vulcan philosophy and the inner glimpse we get into the inner conflict of Vulcan philosophy and the evolution of Vulcan philosophy. It's not really terribly relevant to philosophy here in the real world, I think. But for philosophy inside the Star Trek universe, you know, I don't think you can get a better peek inside Vulcan philosophy. Philosophy than in that arc, so that's on my list as well.
Yeah, the Vulcan arc is also on mine, mostly because of the ethics of force mind melds and Katras, and that could also be interpreted with medical ethics, you know, performing a surgical procedure on someone against their will because they were trying to remove the Katra from Archer against his will.
And the Forge, by the way, number three on my list. That seems to be a popular one for all the reasons that we mentioned. But you know, one of the things that I found most fascinating was the conversation and why I kind of segregated the Forge from that three story arc is the conversation that takes place between Admiral Forrest and Saval, in which Saval admits to Admiral Forrest that he sees humanity by and large, the same way he views his own culture. He sees the parallels, and I think he's talking about, you know, the common ideas and the common ethics, and there are a lot of commonalities that he sees. I found that to be a really fascinating deep dive into that Vulcan philosophy, and I think we learn a lot about how it is that humanity and Vulcan become, you know, these pillars of this thing that we came to know as the Federation. Because despite our differences, we're really very much alike as a species.
Well, I always found it interesting in that particular arc and in that episode that you actually saw a little bit more of a similarity with the militants of Earth and the militants of the Vulcan High Command under Velos, and the spirituality that was trying to be rediscovered through what was happening in the Forge and through T'Pol and T'Pau, because I loved seeing T'Pau in there historically.
Yes.
Because, you know, she from a mock time. And just the struggle to be able to use the nature of the Kirshara and the rediscovery of Surax Katra to bring these two people together, because in many ways the Vulcans were lost, and Velos felt that this supreme military order and the way that he had everyone kind of bending to his will was so anti-Vulcan It was there's a really funny line where I think that Saval was like just getting really agitated with Archer, and he's like, you know, you're spending way too much time with this because look at you, you're acting in your outbursts of emotion, and you're just getting, you're becoming a little bit more human. I think that in many ways, the Vulcan people were split right down the middle, and they were almost trying to suppress what was happening with you know, Kirshara, the artifact that Archer had, and the truth. Because the truth was is that, you know, this philosophy was supposed to be the philosophy that was the guiding hand for Vulcans, and somewhere along the line it was lost. But why are you trying to suppress it? Because it would just make our people a greater people again, and even maybe inspire other races to be able to follow in our tradition. So I thought that was interesting that Archer was the catalyst to bring those two people together, and actually the catalyst for the truth.
I was really pleased to see this direction in the fourth season of Enterprise, because one thing that was really struck me as a kind of a stark contrast at the very beginning of Enterprise in season one was the portrayal of the Vulcans. You know, they were very different, portrayed very differently than the Vulcans we'd seen elsewhere in Star Trek. And finally, we get an explanation for why are all these Vulcans acting so different and being more confrontational than we remember them being. We finally get an explanation, and of course, I don't know how much of this was foresight. Like, they'd always wanted to take the Vulcans in this direction, and how much of this was retroactively explaining how they'd written previous seasons. But I was pleased they kind of brought it all together at the end of Enterprise.
No, they weren't that different. I mean, just look at T'Pring.
Yeah, that's true.
Justin, I'm going to botch his last name. Ozer. Justin Ozer on the Babel conference actually commented under a post that I put out there about this particular podcast. Justin says that Kirshara is his favorite essential philosophies because he said, quote, of the questions it raises, how does it affect a person to have the soul of a great philosopher from a different world within them and then to give that up? How does that affect Archer's outlook and actions for the rest of the season and for the rest of his life, end quote. Now, Zachary, it occurs to me that's probably your ultimate fantasy, to have the Katra of Immanuel Kant.
Kant! Oh, I was going to say my ultimate fantasy was going to Ryza, but shows how well you know me, I guess.
Shipmates, here we come.
See our episode on hedonism, right? Yeah.
But no, Justin, thank you for that comment. And I think that really just highlights one of the reasons why this particular arc seems to resonate with all of us here.
I think that's a really good point, because I think at the end of Sarek, when Sarek mind melded with Picard, and then that was tapped into at the end of Unification Part 2, Picard still had the essence of Sarek in him, in a way. I mean, I think the fingerprint is still there. Even if the entire Katra was removed, the influence is still there. So I think that will inform, unfortunately we wouldn't see it, but it would inform who Archer would be in some way. There's going to be an echo, you know, of Sarek, the greatest Vulcan philosopher, you know, ever. And how did that help Archer become Admiral Archer and then eventually become the first president of the United Federation of Planets?
Right.
Well, you know, we don't get to see very much on screen, but we do get to see Archer a few years later at the founding of the Federation, right?
A little bit, yeah.
Is there any influence there at all, or is it not enough to go on?
I probably have to say a little bit. I mean, we're taking like the collective, like everything, like, you know, what he learned throughout the course of his command and then all the people that he's interacted with. But, you know, he is, you know, it's kind of like, you know, Bones is like when he said to, you know, it's the ultimate revenge for Spock on me is like, you know, putting his Katra in my head, you know. Eventually, when that was removed, you know, on Mount Salea, there has to be a little bit still left in there, because it shared the same spiritual existence in the same vessel, you know. So, and here's I'm going to throw this right into the melting pot of all we're talking about. So what happens if a person who is suffering from a mind meld goes through a transporter and doesn't completely come out exactly the same way on the other side? Just saying.
I think you lost me there.
Norm drops his mic. This is.
I'm just saying.
Yeah.
I think we'll have to get back to you on that one. That sounds like a complicated issue.
On the next episode of Metatrex, Norm gets kicked off the ship or transported down.
Speaking of transporters, we're just going to transport you into space for that one.
It's probably a good idea. I would.
Unless you object for any reason. Yeah. Well, I've been trying to keep track of where we are on the list here. So I've got three episodes from Norm, three episodes from me, three episodes from Mike. Jeff, I only have two for you. I've got you down for Observer Effect and The Forge. Am I missing one from you that we already covered?
I mentioned that Daedalus was one of my honorable mentions, but my third was Affliction from the Klingon arc. That was mostly just because this arc was mentioned before, but my take on it was more from the outlook of the ethics of Section 31 and covert operations. It seemed to be that Enterprise took a different tack on Section 31 than Deep Space Nine did, because in Deep Space Nine they were shown to be like everything that was wrong, and you know, they were something that needed to be weeded out and exposed and just totally horrible and something that could not be allowed to stand. And in this arc, and especially later in the novels too, but in this arc, and it was more like they were a necessary evil, and they were there trying to do the dirty work so that others didn't have to do it. And it was an interesting difference in the approach. And I have to wonder if that was a result of Deep Space Nine being produced in the 90s during the Clinton administration and the politics of that time versus this being produced post 9/11, where there was a lot more stuff like that going on with the military and more people were aware of these covert operations going on.
Yeah, well, this is one of those kind of, let's create a clause to be able to exercise executive powers as need be, because wasn't Section 31, the name actually comes from the bylaws of the Federation, Section 31.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It was Starfleet Charter, Section 31.
Right. So they basically gave themselves an out. Like, if something really, really terrible happens, we have this clause where we can act in kind.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but you're right. When I was watching that in Deep Space Nine, it was Luther Sloan, right? In Section 31. They were more like, they were more like kind of like the Black Hat, as opposed to like this tactical squad, this tactical response squad that is. I'm sure that the Section 31 even had better gear than the Makos, like stuff that we didn't even know about, right?
Highly experimental, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Because they are the rapid response team to anything extreme.
So. Yeah, the way I saw it was by the time of Deep Space Nine, they had gone from being this covert ops team that could be sent in to fix a problem, but they were still answerable to someone in Starfleet intelligence. By the time of Deep Space Nine, they had kind of become so deeply in the black that nobody even knew that they existed anymore. They had no oversight, and they were just as bad as the Tal Shiar were.
It's an interesting point because, I mean, it's a very, I think, you know, we as Americans, I think we have this innate suspect of power grabbing, right? We don't like it.
Yeah.
And, you know, once legislators realize that they can write themselves power, it can be a very slippery slope from there. And how do you simultaneously empower people in a position of influence to do what they need to do to keep the country and the civilization and the population safe, while simultaneously putting limits on the ability to keep grabbing an increasing amount of power in the name of security and protection and the like. It's an incredibly relevant issue, and I think the ongoing fear is that as legislators write themselves power, that will just be a slippery slope and will continue to lead to some really unhappy end.
But here's the interesting thing about this. So like in modern times, like now, when something happens and you have to create like a special organization or have to divert funding, you have Senate oversight committees. Where's the money going? Where's the funding going? Who's going to be funded and how many people you're going to need in a society where money has no value anymore? This is a society of Star Trek and the economies of scale based on the Federation and Starfleet. who accounts for the who accounts for somebody like this? They can basically write a blank check for all the weaponry they need, all the armaments they need, all the ships they need, all the personnel they need, and it has absolutely $0 amount to it. So they can literally create any type of response mechanism they want for anything. I mean, that's kind of like what they were trying to get at with Admiral Marcus and the Vengeance.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Because it literally has, you can't, there's no money trail.
If each side essentially has the power to create their own weaponry, you know, without any having to worry about expenditure of resources, all these things that committees oversee, then why aren't we in this runaway arms race in the Federation?
Oh, and that's a great question. But the fascinating thing to me is we have in society today a lack of oversight because these things tend to get, you know, tucked inside other things and, you know, hidden in spreadsheets so that they're virtually untraceable. So that's a great question, Norm, in a society where there really is no economy. Why not engage in a runaway arms race? And I think that's honestly exactly what Section 31, and for that matter in the JJ verse, the Vengeance represents.
Well, I always found it funny that the Makos had better weaponry, but better always equates to investment. You know, how much, you know, who is running the arms race and how much do you have to spend in order to get better technology? If there is no economy of this type of scale, everyone should have the exact same thing.
Indeed.
You know,
indeed.
So I always found that funny, like, because now you're putting the limiter of an economy on there. It's like, well, those guns are okay, but if you spent more money, you would get these guns, you know? So.
Well, and I think in my head canon, it's not so much the dollars and cents of it. It's you've got the military developing their own weapons and their own equipment, and then you have Starfleet doing their own thing. And it really wasn't until probably these two were folded in together somewhere pre-TOS era that all of those resources were combined.
That's a fair point.
That's just my headcanon and a little retconning.
No, because the Makos always like saying, like, well, you don't have, you know, the phased rifle, particle rifle Mark II. What do you have? You know, an old something, something, something. And, you know, Reed's like, yeah, you know, it's got us this far, though.
Yeah, it was interesting how it developed into the novels, too, based on the start that they got from this episode. You know, because they did the whole rewrite of These Are the Voyages, and that tied in, like, Section 31 into that and into the Romulan War. And it was really interesting because they actually have, basically, they're implying that Section 31 covered up that the Romulans were an offshoot of the Vulcans to preserve this this alliance, because if everyone else found out that the Romulans and the Vulcans were related, they'd turn on the Vulcans.
The good that men do.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Great book.
Yeah, and it was really interesting that they went in that direction, because that has them able to show that, yeah, these people found out that there was a connection, but then it got covered up, and it gave a plausible explanation for why they would cover it up.
And Trip.
And Trip.
So, Jeff, anything else on your list there? You should have another honorable mention, I believe.
Yes, my other honorable mention was the Augment arc, just because of the questions of the ethics of genetic engineering.
Yes.
That's on mine as well.
How far is too far? And, what do we allow? What do we not? And, you know, where do we draw the line?
And, you know, my favorite scene in that arc is the scene where Dr. Sung is basically in jail, and he's got these notes on the wall of all these, you know, genetic engineering improvements, curing this disease, making that improvement. And he says that, you know, in a week or so, someone's going to come through, clean it all out, and they're going to basically, you know, torch the notes, and none of it will ever come to fruition. And he just thinks this is ridiculous. You know, I can make all these improvements. This is technology. We can, you know, make lives better. And, you know, Archer basically says, that's not what you're doing. You're redefining the species. And it's a fascinating discussion about You know, the costs and benefits of making those kinds of improvements. What are the risks and what are the potential benefits? You know, what's the relevance of naturalism? You know, is it important for a species to stay on a natural trajectory and evolve at its own rate? Or is it acceptable to make improvements for these utilitarian or consequentialist concerns about preventing harm or suffering and increasing quality of life and curing diseases and whatnot? And, you know, there's no real answer at the end of the day. And we've commented many times on Metatrex that Star Trek usually does a better job of raising questions and considering the options than actually giving you the answer. It's up to we, the viewers and listeners, to be philosophical and think about what the best answers might be. But I love that genetic engineering arc because, again, this is a contemporary situation. You know, we have the ability to improve ourselves as a species. To what extent should we do that? And what are the limits on that? And I love they make this not just one episode, but a 3-episode arc. So I likewise group these together into a 3-episode arc, and that's one of my alternates as well.
So, Norm and Jeff, since you guys are the guests here, we'll throw it to the both of you for some final thoughts before we let you guys beam back over to the NX-01. Norman?
Well, you know, what I loved about being on here for this discussion, and Mike, you've been on Warp 5 and when I was on as one of the hosts. When we did Warp 5 then, we were talking a little bit more about kind of the nuts and bolts of episodes and the storylines and some of just the intricate natures of the episodes, but not necessarily at the philosophical level. And I think this episode will probably give people the opportunity to know that Enterprise actually does and can and did go deeper than most people realized, not just in terms of the questions and some of the points that we've raised here, but how truly the writers did understand where they needed to go, especially in the fourth season, to make En-ROADS into the original series. And that's not an easy thing to do because everyone's expecting everything to go a certain direction. But with episodes like The Observer Effect, where they introduce the Organians, and in a way where you really rethink kind of the Organians weren't these jovial, middle-aged looking guys who were just kind of, you know, spiritual vessels of the representation of human, you know, human people. But they were actually a little bit more aggressive than that. And it challenges you. So I really liked having the opportunity here. Thank you guys for having me on and to discuss some of these finer points, because there are deeper lessons to be learned from Enterprise if those episodes and this series is just given more of a chance. That's the one thing that we always tried to fight for in Warp 5, ever since Christopher started to when I did it to in the way that everyone's doing it on now, with Jeff and Floyd and sometimes you, Mike, and when Will was on with us, and Tommy. You know, there is a great series there. It's just that some people don't see it for or from the surface level. And I hope that this discussion just gives people the opportunity to know that it can be understood at a completely and more just connective level to them. And I think that's a great way of approaching going backwards from season 4 to season 1, because season 4 does have the most connective tissue to the original series.
Yeah, I just really hope that this episode really helps people show that, you know, they really were thinking about, what was going on in the world around them while they were writing these episodes. And just like the original series, they were having some commentary. It just wasn't quite as blatant as some of the episodes from the original series in the commentary. And there are some really interesting points, a lot of really thought-provoking episodes in the show throughout all 4 seasons. And some of the stuff that didn't seem right, that turned people off at the beginning of the series, paid off in the 4th season. And that's one thing that streaming has helped for Enterprise, is that people are able to go back and binge watch it and see how these things have paid off. And that's something that they couldn't do when it first aired, and they didn't see where it was going. And a lot of people just didn't really give it the chance from the start. And now they can go back and look at it with a fresh perspective and just give it another shot, and I think a lot of people are discovering that there's a lot more to it than they originally thought.
Indeed. I do want to mention Floyd Dorsey, the host of Warp 5 with you, Jeff, was hoping to be able to join us this evening, but he was actually recruited by Section 31, and he's on a training mission and wasn't able to join in. So, Floyd, this one's for you. Dedicate this this one to you and all the great work that Norm and Will started. Well, actually, Christopher started, and Norm and Will continued, and now is continuing through Floyd and Jeff. I, as a huge fan of Enterprise and an associate producer of Warp 5, it's just been an honor and a privilege to have you guys join us here on the Starship Theseus. And so, Norm, before you beam back over to the NX-01, hopefully with no one else's Katra but your own, because we don't want there to be any errors in that beaming pattern. Where can our
I don't know, my Katra's for sale, you know? If you want to take it with you,
where can our listeners find you on Trek FM and around the interwebs?
Well, as you mentioned earlier, I'm an executive producer for Trek FM, and you could find me online always on the Babel Conference, because I post there pretty much daily. I love interacting with all of our listeners. I am a patron as well of Trek FM for several of the shows. And you can find me along with Mr. Ataz as co-hosts for Standard Orbit, the Trek FM dedicated podcast for the original series. And you can find me on Twitter at Starfighter1701. So thank you, Mike. Thank you, Zach, for having me on the show. I appreciate it.
Absolutely.
Thanks, Norm.
And Jeff, when you're not beaming back and forth between the 22nd and 23rd centuries, where can our listeners find you around Trek FM and the interwebs?
Well, if you don't have access to an Atavacron or even a 30th century temporal discriminator, you can always find me on the Babel Conference on Facebook. I'm the co-host on the network, both for Standard Orbit, the Trek FM's dedicated original series show, and also for Warp 5, Trek FM's dedicated Enterprise show. And I'm also on Twitter at Harlander, and I'm a supporter of the network through Patreon. And like you mentioned earlier, you can check out my website, trekopedia.com. It's been called the Grand Unified Theory of Star Trek. And then my independent comic books at bandwidthcomics.com. And you can search on Facebook for those at Bandwidth Comics.
As our listeners can ascertain, Jeffrey is not a very busy guy at all.
No, well, I have absolutely nothing going on.
Well, again, guys, it has been an honor to have you here on MetaTrex. Hope you'll join us again in the future.
Or in the past, because we have access to time travel. That's why Jeff can get so much done.
I don't know. The Vulcans don't approve.
Yeah. That's right. They don't believe it exists.
Exactly. All right. Thanks, you guys. I'm glad you guys could join us. Thanks, guys. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, Mike, that was so much fun having Norm and Jeffrey on the show with us today.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. It amazes me, getting fresh perspectives. You know, you and I, we're 28 episodes in and we've got a certain rapport. We're to the point now, occasionally we can trip each other up, but you know, we generally know the direction, each of us are going in a conversation, and to kind of get that fresh perspective that, Jeff and Norm, brought to the conversation. It was a lot of fun.
I thought it was really fun that we didn't compare notes beforehand. You know, everyone's picks were a total surprise to me and to you.
Yes.
And I didn't know what to expect. I didn't know if we were all going to pick the same three episodes and we'd have a 10-minute long show, or if we'd all have picked different episodes and we'd never get done. I'm pleased there was just a lot of overlap. And it says to me there really is some core, there are some core episodes to Enterprise. You know, it's not the entire season. It's, you know, maybe, you know, 8 or 9 or 10 episodes of the series or the season that count as sort of essential philosophical Star Trek. But there is a lot of overlap. A lot of us picked the mini arc of the genetic engineering arc. A lot of us picked Demons and Terra Prime. Just a lot of overlap. So I'm pleased. And for me personally, I was one of these people that had to learn to appreciate Enterprise. I was really busy when Enterprise came out with grad school and I didn't really get into it. And then I started to get into it right as it got canceled. And I just never gave it the chance that it deserves. And for me, it's really interesting to discover as a philosopher just how philosophically rich the season 4 of Enterprise really is, and how much material the writers were trying to pack into this show, you know, to make it both philosophically interesting, relevant to what was going on in society and politics and at the time period. And it makes use of some grand themes that are universal, mm-hmm. and it has some stuff that's very relevant for the times. It's everything you would expect from Star Trek. And I'm really kind of disappointed that it doesn't get more appreciated for its virtues, given all of that.
Norm was absolutely spot on with his final comments. It Enterprise doesn't get the credit that it's due. And you're absolutely right. The fact that there was some overlap, but it's interesting, even though we overlapped on a few episodes, the particular philosophical themes that drew us to them oftentimes were different, or we had a different perspective. And I noticed, for instance, on the Babel conference, we had thrown this question out to the delegates. And, you know, for instance, The Forge, Kirshara, those particular episodes resonated with a few people. Alan McDonald, for instance, saw significance in Admiral Forrest's sacrifice, where he sacrificed himself for Saval in The Forge. And so it's just fascinating because we can be drawn to particular episodes, but the themes and the observations that we make oftentimes were different. It was just a lot of fun having those guys join us and talk Star Trek and philosophy.
I think it speaks a lot to how rich these episodes really are. The fact that you can not only find, a handful of episodes, but for those episodes where there was agreement, there were different takes on it. There's more than one issue going on in that episode. And because of that, just no shortage of material to talk about. And of course, you know, we joked at the beginning of the show that we'd learn a lot about each other from our choices. And I think philosophy is a little bit like that. You know, everyone is drawn to certain philosophical issues and certain ways of looking at things. And, philosophy for me is this really interesting intersection of, you know, the issues that are being discussed and then the individual's take on those issues. It's almost a hermeneutical problem. It was just fun to hear other perspectives besides. I always hear you. I hear you, once a week. I was tired of listening to you. I wanted to listen to Norm and Jeffrey talk about these episodes.
I'm quite sick of you as well, Zachary.
Well, you're get used to it. We're going to be here for a while.
So. You know, I made the joke about Daedalus, you know, taking something old, making it new, something old, something new. But, you know, it strikes me, Zachary, that this is very true, I think, of Enterprise. And again, it harkens back to the notion that it doesn't get the credit, I think, that it's due. And my hope here at the end of the day, and this is really my final thought, in discussing season four of Enterprise, which I think of the four seasons that we got of this particular series, I find this particular season very rich of philosophical themes, that something old might become new if we look at it with a fresh perspective and really dive deep and recognize and realize that we really got here in this particular series more Trek, I think, than what most people realize.
Yeah, and I'm really pleased it's not just regurgitating old stories and old ways of approaching these issues. It's a real challenge, I think, after 750 hours of Star Trek on television to continue, revisiting these philosophical issues, but in new ways that really add something to the discussion and move the discussion forward, rather than just rehashing old stories and rehashing old ways of considering the issues, making it relevant for today and telling those stories in new ways. And Enterprise was doing that, and I hope it really gets appreciated for that in the long run.
Indeed.
Well, Mike, it's been fun talking about essential philosophical Star Trek and season four of Enterprise, but this isn't the only thing we've been talking about here on Trek FM this past week. So here's a quick look at some of the other things you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
And I'm saying this in a really good and loving way. Sometimes some things can't be unseen, but there is nothing cooler than Disco Bones. I mean, I know we're supposed to be in the 23rd century somewhere, but that was squarely 1970-something.
Oh, yeah, sure. It was perfect.
The Orb.
And you paused for a bit thinking about it, and then baseball.
Yeah, and you would have thought I would have got that since I have one on my desk.
That's right, you do, yes.
Yeah.
Which you often fondle as we record The Orb, I must say.
Well, I wouldn't have chosen those words, Chris, but let's just move right along.
To the journey!
I mean, I remember when this thing aired, I just thought, okay, they really are going to go through with this thing. They've been hinting at it for almost a year now, and this is actually going to go forward. I guess the joke was on me, but it gave me a lot of freaking hope and a lot of fanfic ideas.
Literary Treks.
One of my issues I had with this whole series is as a graphic novel, is I was expecting one continuous story, and each chapter was an issue that was separate from each other.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out these shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button. That helps us out greatly and makes it easier for other listeners to find the shows as they search iTunes. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Stitcher, TuneIn, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and of course you can stream and download the MP3 file from our website and grab the RSS link as well. Another way you can help us keep all of our shows coming to you each week is to become a patron of the network through Patreon. If you visit patreon.com/trekfm, that's patreon.com/trekfm, you'll find our current goals and different milestone contribution levels, along with all of the great perks we have for you. These perks include early access to content, exclusive content, producer credits, seats in our content development team, and many more. We really appreciate any support you can give us and hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. And don't forget to check out Enterprise in Space, a project of the nonprofit National Space Society that will design and launch an 8-foot orbiter and return the craft to Earth. The NSS Enterprise Orbiter will carry more than 100 student-designed science experiments into space, and you can help make it happen. Visit enterpriseinspace.org to find out more and to get your seat on the mission. If you'd like to contact us with feedback or suggestions for the show, or to send us your thoughts on anything we discussed in this episode of MetaTreks, you can contact us in several different ways. You can contact us via a form on Trek FM's website. Just go to trek.fm/contact.
You can also leave us a voicemail. Just go to the sidebar on the show page or go to speakpipe.com/trekfm.
On Twitter, you can find us under the handle @trekfm.
You can also find us on Facebook. It's facebook.com/trekfm. Also, while you're there, check out the Babel Conference. Just type the Babel Conference, that's B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook or go to our website at trek.fm and click discussion on the menu bar.
We also invite you to leave a rating and a review of MetaTreks on iTunes. We'd love to hear your feedback and suggestions for the show. Well, Mike, when you are not writing Season 5 of Enterprise, where can our listeners find you on the interwebs and around the Trek FM network these days?
Well, Zachary, I'm most active on Facebook, certainly in the Babel Conference. On Twitter, my Twitter handle is @cmichael1701. I'm also on Instagram, cmichael1701. And as I mentioned previously, I'm a proud supporter of the network and associate producer for Warp 5. So, Zachary, when you're not carrying around the cadre of famous philosophers from history, where can our listeners find you around the network and on the interwebs?
Well, I am an associate producer for The Ready Room, Trek FM's flagship show, and you can also find me on several recent episodes of that show as well. On Facebook, if you'd like to talk Star Trek and philosophy with me, you can find me in Trek FM's listeners group, the Babel Conference. And on Twitter, you can find me under the handle @ZacharyFruhling. That's Zachary, Z-A-C-H-A-R-Y, and Fruhling, F-R-U-H-L-I-N-G. We'd like to take a moment to acknowledge the rest of the MetaTreks team from the network, specifically C. Brian Jones, the founder and publisher of Trek FM, our executive producers, Charlin Schmidt, Matthew Rushing, and some guy named Norman Lau, Aaron Harvey, our art director, Will Wynn, our content manager, Richard Marquez, our production manager, and Dennis Costello, our editor and producer. And we'd also like to give a special thank you to our associate producer, Patrick Devlin. Patrick, we'd really like to thank you for your support of MetaTreks and for the Trek FM network in general. If you'd like to get in touch with Patrick, you can find him under the Twitter handle @MagicDrop5. Well, everyone, thanks for listening to MetaTreks, a Star Trek philosophy podcast. Until next time, when we will once again boldly go where no philosophers have gone before.